This is Ken Samuelson, and I'm here in Farington Village in North Carolina. My address is 4019 Farington Post, Pittsburgh, North Carolina. My telephone number is 919-542-0674. And I'm here with Renee Fink, who is a Holocaust survivor, Shoah survivor, as she indicates, and we'll talk about that a little bit. And she lives here in Farington. And if you would, Renee, just identify yourself for the audience, so to speak.
I'm Renee Fink, and I also live in Farington Village. And my address is 612 Farington Post, Pittsboro, North Carolina.
Okay. And Renee, you've lived here a number of years, I know. And Renee, of course, is a survivor of those dark days in Germany. When were you born, Renee, again?
Well, actually, I never was in Germany.
Oh, you never were in Germany.
My family is entirely German, and they fled Germany in 1933. I was born in Holland in 1937, and that's where I spent the war.
Oh, I see. Okay. So you're born in Holland then in 1937, and of course, obviously being just an infant, you don't recall much, but Do you have from your family any information about what was going on at that time, even though you were obviously too young to remember, but maybe your parents talked to you a little bit about
things? My parents didn't survive, so people didn't tend to talk to me about the war. They didn't have answers when I asked questions. So I do have memories because the formative war years for me were between the age of 4 and 8.
Mm-hmm.
So when times became really bad, I was no longer an infant. And there's scattered memories.
Mm-hmm. So what would be your earliest recollection of an event that maybe kind of rings in your memory, beginning?
Well, I didn't know anything until the age of 4, and the most profound event that happened in my entire life, I could say, would be the day that I went into hiding in 1942, when everyone had to disappear.
When you say everyone had to disappear, can you give a little information?
The Jews were being rounded up, mm-hmm. and they either went into hiding or they were taken in SS raids called razzias.
Mm-hmm.
And so arrangements had to be made very quickly, and I went into hiding in 1942.
Mm-hmm.
I have no idea what month or what time of year, but I think it was warm. I don't think I had heavy clothing.
And do you recall, I mean, that's obviously going back to a long time ago, do you recall at the age even of 4, fear or trepidation? You're saying, gosh, what are we doing? Or even at that
no
age?
No anticipatory fear, because for one thing, in those days, maybe you can relate to this, children were to be seen and not heard.
Mm-hmm.
Adults didn't discuss adult things in the presence of children.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, in the war, ignorance was the only way to survive. You couldn't know what was going on. And certainly not a little 4-year-old child
sure.
could be let in on what was the reality day to day. So I had no anticipatory fear, and I knew nothing by design. All I know is that I was placed by my parents on a stranger's bike, and I never saw my parents again.
Oh, really?
And went into hiding on the back of a total stranger's bicycle to another house. I don't remember how many hours I was on the bike, but little children didn't ask questions. They just behaved.
So you were put on a bicycle, and you had no idea who
the
person was?
Or knew nothing.
Yeah. And you don't recall how far you went or anything of that nature. Were you still in the same city, or do you have any
recollection? No, I was not. I went to an entirely different town.
Uh-huh.
It may have been the same province,
mm-hmm.
but it would have been a lengthy bicycle ride. Mm-hmm. I don't know in terms of hours.
Yeah.
But later in the day, I found myself in what seemed to be a large house.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know what I was doing there.
And you missed your mom and dad, I'm
sure.
Very
much.
And you were wondering what's going on, because at that age,
yes,
you didn't know.
I did know.
And your life in this new environment then, were you, was it a normal life? Were you actually hidden in a room? Or
there was no normal life, number one, for anybody. There was no such thing. But I have to be honest and say that as a little child, I wouldn't have had a basis for comparison, so I didn't know what was normal.
Right.
And whatever I was living was totally normal.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that it was very much of a hardship was as normal as being hungry or cold or anything else. But what wasn't normal was that 8 children came home into this house. And so I suddenly found myself an only child in a house with 2 parents and 8 children.
Did you have any brothers and sisters?
No.
No. Okay, I'm not a child. Okay, so you were in this house, and as I said, you're so young, you probably, it's difficult to recall too much. But as you stayed in this home, do you recall feeling threatened in any way, or were you able to, did you have food and so forth, sufficient food? Do you remember any of that?
I do remember that. But in 1942, there was still food.
Mm-hmm.
But whatever food there was had to be split 11 ways.
Mm-hmm.
And it might have been a chicken as a very, very special meal. One chicken, while the chicken supply held out, we would slaughter a chicken once a week.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember that I thought it was the greatest thing. We'd cut the chicken's head off and it would just jump around.
Right.
And I thought it was a great big delight. If you think in terms of today, splitting a not-so-large chicken 11 ways, and that was a feast, you begin to imagine. And this is when there was still food.
Mm-hmm.
Food enough.
Mm-hmm.
But as we got deeper into the war, times got more difficult.
This was in like 1942 initially, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Okay, now as you got deeper into the war, can you just kind of open-ended for you to tell me, what do you recall about getting deeper into the war?
When I first found my voice in this very large family, having come from something so totally different, I kind of became excited because we had 1 cow, we had a couple of pigs and some chickens, and I thought I was living on a farm, which was very exciting to a little Jewish girl who had been an only child, to be in this surrounding. That's when I acclimated. And I began to walk around and talk about the pigs and the cow. And before I knew it, maybe this lasted for an hour or so, but before I knew it, I was kind of, they put a lid on my enthusiasm. I don't know how else to really explain it. I wasn't to talk about anything like that. Nobody was to know anything.
That you had any?
That we had any food,
cows or pigs.
Or that there were any boys in the house who mm-hmm. could be conscripted by the Germans.
Mm-hmm.
And that everything had to be very, very quiet. So at that point, I think I became very hidden. And I didn't talk until the 90s.
Hmm.
Nobody knew anything about me.
Were you the youngest child in this
yes.
group of children?
So, yes.
And do you recall how old the oldest might have been?
Well, the youngest of the children in this wonderful family was about 6 years older than I.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can imagine there was quite an age range with 8 children.
Mm-hmm.
Some were born in closer time proximity, But there was still a very big range, and the oldest were definitely old enough to be married, but nobody could marry or live normally. So I can't tell you the age range.
They were old enough to serve in the service, so if somebody...
Some of the boys.
Found out about them.
And I don't think, I really don't think the Germans would have cared if, you know, one of the sons was 17 or 18 or 16, if they had been found. So there was a lot of fear.
Well, so far as your education is concerned, did they do any schooling of the children or this kind of thing?
I don't remember whether their children were going to school, but you know, they must have been the younger ones. I did not go to school. I never went to school. It was too dangerous for little dark-haired children to appear in school and for people to explain their presence. Some little Jewish children had their hair dyed if they didn't blend in. My hair was never dyed, and I was very, very petite and very dark. You can't tell now because I have white hair, but I had great big black eyes, people told me. They would say, go home and wash your eyes. And I was very small boned, and the family was on the blonder, very large boned side. So I went to a kind of kindergarten for 3 years because the teacher was my oldest Catholic sister's. I became a total part of this family. It may have been my second hiding place, but it's where I was lucky enough to stay the entire time, so I was never on the run. And I can explain to you later how many types of hiding there were.
The school that you went to, was this a schoolhouse or was it a home school of some kind?
No, it wasn't a home school. I thought I went to a Catholic school because the nuns came every lunch hour to comb our hair because we all had lice. We had every kind of parasite. Why? I only know about myself. I had every kind of parasite a human body could have. And so because nuns came every day with their wimples. I remember I wanted to be either a nurse or a nun because nurses had the same wimples. I thought it was a Catholic school, but I can't really tell you other than that our teacher, well, so-called teacher, she didn't teach us anything, was my oldest sister's best friend, so it was safe for me to be in that place.
When you say your oldest sister, that what you call
the Catholic, my Catholic, my adoptive.
Yeah, your adoptive
my
family.
My foster family. Mm-hmm, yeah, it was my foster family.
Right.
I will refer to them as sisters and brothers, but they are all the Catholic family who took me in and saved my life.
Right.
So it was safe for me. No questions would be asked.
I see. Okay, so and you say you were actually in hiding, even though you went to a school and so forth, you went to school.
But there are different types of hiding. Some people were hidden, like Anna Frank, who is the famous hidden child.
Right.
And she was literally in hiding, not coming out on the street. I was hidden, meaning that my identity was changed, my name and my religion, and I lived with another name as a Catholic child, going to church every Sunday, learning catechism. But I was more openly hidden, meaning I could be outside on the street and I could go to this very safe school place. There were no pencils, there was no paper, there was nothing, no books. So we didn't learn anything in school. We just killed time for 3 years. I had a little piece of wool, so we learned to knit, and it was a little like the tale of Sisyphus, which is an existential tale.
They changed your name. What was your name before and after?
I've had a lot of names. My birth name was Renata Lazar. And
L-A-S-E-R.
And then I became Rita van der Brink.
A good Dutch name.
That was a very good Dutch name. And van der Brink is the name of the family who saved me.
Mm-hmm.
So Renata would not have fit into that scenario. And then after the war, I went back to Renata Lazar. And then I came to America in 1948, and suddenly I became Renee, because I had an uncle who survived. But that's another whole story.
Okay.
He said my name would be mispronounced as Renate, so it would henceforth be Renee. And I lived with them briefly, so suddenly it was Renee Leipzig. But then I went to live in a more permanent place in the Adirondack Mountains, and I got the name of that family, which was Renee Schrenk. And it went back and forth, but then it became Renee Leipzig legally. Then I married, and I became Renee Fink. So I've only been married once, but I had five last names.
Isn't that amazing?
I was married once for 45 years.
Yeah.
And three first names.
How about it? And when your husband?
My husband died in 2003.
Oh, yes.
But just getting back to the school, I had this little piece of wool and I knit. And when we came to the end of the wool, it would be unraveled and we'd start all over again. And that's how I spent 3 years, to my recollection.
So do you knit today or do you?
No. I never made anything. Just knit, because the wool would have run out before anything could have been formed.
Right, I see. You didn't have much.
But
wool.
At home, my sisters were knitting, and I would hold my hands while they rolled the wool. So we did that. That was a regular pastime in the house. We all had little jobs at home. There was no electricity.
So it was, in the wintertime, it was cold too, I assume, very
Holland
cold.
Holland is a very cold,
yeah,
very damp, very cold.
So did you find yourself, your family, a lot of colds and this kind of thing? Were you able to keep warm with fires?
We didn't
so
have doctors. I don't remember being seriously ill, which is a good thing because there was no medical care. If I had a very severe sore throat, somehow a spoon of honey would magically appear. But it's not like we had treats like that. But it was soothing if you had a bad enough throat.
Right.
I don't remember illness. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that we didn't get sick, but I just don't remember.
Remember being cold, though?
I remember being cold. I remember being hungry, and I remember not being able to sit still because of all the parasites.
Oh, yeah.
So.
Did they have any wood to burn in a fireplace or this kind of thing, or wood pretty in short supply, too?
I remember after the war, when I lived for a few years with my aunt and my grandmother, we were the only three who survived the war. We had a tiny coal-burning stove, or that also burned wood, and it was the only source of anything in the house. I think we must have had a wood or a coal stove because the sisters cooked.
Yeah, so they had something to cook with, right?
But and they used to heat those old-fashioned irons to do the ironing. There were always two or three irons on the stove heating.
Did you? In your daily life after you moved with the Brink, it was a Brink family?
Van der Brink.
Van der Brink family. After you moved to them, did you have occasion to see the presence of German soldiers and so forth around? Did you? And what was your attitude and what were you told about how to act and so forth? Do you recall anything about that?
Oh, yeah, because we lived in a not good part of a not good country to be living in during the war. We lived in a very occupied region of Holland, and there were Germans all around. But sometimes we had a little bit of warning through the underground. There were no telephones or anything, but the underground was very active. And this is why I'm alive today, because of the underground and the fact that they found a place for me. So if we had warning, the boys would hide. They would put me in bed, even though I was dressed, but pull the covers up. And Germans would come to confiscate either people or things like radios, or if they wanted blankets or whatever they wanted, they just took. And then there were all these rules of things you weren't allowed to have, like radios. So the Germans were largely a bunch of cowards, because the family would just say that I had TB.
Oh, that would keep them away, huh?
And they would run. I mean, if they came and poked their heads in the room where they had found time to hide me under the covers in a bed, the Germans would make a quick getaway. They would just point to their chests and go, and then point to me. And that would be the end of that. But if there was no warning time and the Germans just came, they would stick me in the corner of the house and put a dunce cap. I don't dunce even cap. Know how people came to have dunce caps on my head and point to me and just make the crazy sign.
Yeah.
So hopefully they would leave me alone. And there was tremendous fear, because these things happened.
Oh, and as a child, I'm sure the fears were even magnified more than...
Well, no, I felt the fear of the whole house. I mean, the fear in the house was palpable.
Permeated
because
everything.
The Germans were really all around us, and we were in a very bombed area as well. So it was never life as we know normal life to be.
Now, what happened to your brothers then? Where did they hide?
They
must have...
Well, I'm a little confused because, you know, the Germans are known for their record keeping and their precise nature. So on the one hand, I think they had numbers for every household, and they would do numbers checks. And sometimes when they came and they would count, the Van der Brink family would send one of their own blonde daughters out, ostensibly to visit an aunt and check up on the health of a relative, so that there wouldn't be too many people in the house, because I was there. So they always risked their lives every day for my being there. But the boys would hide in the attic, and they hid in the hay in the barn, really making themselves as invisible as possible. And they would spend nights in the attic just being totally out of sight, disappearing. So I don't know, I can't reconcile that with the head counts that the Germans would take. I'm not a historian, and I don't know how all these things worked.
Let me share about the Van der Brink family. Why did they take you? Do you know?
I know that someone has done a study of Dutch righteous Christians. I mean, specifically Dutch families who did this, and there is a commonality among them. They did it because they couldn't think of it was the right thing to do. They did it in a very modest and very humble way, and I, as a Catholic child, learned that humility was all important, they didn't do it for any public recognition at any time and were totally uncooperative with me after the war when I tried to have them recognized as righteous Christians at Yad Vashem, and that is the Holocaust Museum in Jerusalem in Israel. And it's kind of the mother of all other Holocaust museums. And there is an avenue of the righteous. And this is Christians. But there, I have to add that there were many Jewish righteous as well, and that Jews fought to save other Jews. Mm-hmm. But this is a recognition of those righteous people who hid and risked their own lives and who saved either, in my case, just me or other families who saved, in some cases, thousands.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So my family was very uncooperative because they did not want public recognition, and they insisted that they didn't do it for that. And I finally convinced my oldest Catholic siblings that it was for history and it wasn't for any glory for the Von der Brink family.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And only after just pleading with them and having them look at it in a larger perspective did they finally agree they would help me, and they are recognized, and their name is in all Holocaust museums now.
Including the one in D.C. also?
Yes, the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum has a wall.
I can look for their name.
You can go there. Anyone can go there and see their names etched in that wall, and it's Gijsbertus Johannes van der Brink and his wife Maria Zoon, Zoon, van der Brink.
Mm-hmm.
And so just look under the V's.
I'll look for it. How do you spell their last name?
It's little V-A-N.
Van der
Brink. And then little D-E-N. And then the third word is capital B-R-I-N-K.
Okay.
So it's phonetic. I mean, there's nothing tricky about it.
Okay, good.
The Gijsbertus is a little tricky because that is G-I-J-S-B-E-R, Gijsbertus, T-U-S.
Well, I'll look for that name when I go up there.
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad you mentioned that. Do you have any ideas to have you ever learned how they found this family that to take you?
I'm sorry. The family had 8 children, and the oldest ones were definitely old enough to marry, and that they didn't marry was because you really couldn't marry during the war for any number of reasons, but they were as good as engaged. And so one of my sisters-in-law, who subsequently became a sister-in-law, her brother happened to have been the chief of this underground in this particular town of Laren, which is in North Holland. That's the province in the Netherlands.
Was that the name of the city too?
Laren is the name of the city.
Yeah, how do you
and
spell
it is
that?
In the Laren.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It is in the province of North Holland, which is North Holland, and that is one of, I think, 11 provinces, I don't remember exactly, of Holland.
Mm-hmm.
So he was, and I know his last name was Vickerman or something like that, don't know his first name. He would have played a part in it. But the underground worked in such a way that there were a lot of cogs in the wheel, and one didn't know what the next one was doing, because if the Germans caught you, you would not be able to give anything or anyone away.
Mm-hmm.
So everyone had a very limited job, and they just did that, and they never understood the larger picture.
Mm-hmm.
So how it worked, I have no idea, but this family was found. Mm. And I have a relationship with the people within this family. And I have three surviving brothers in Australia, and the five children who remained in Holland all died. But sometimes this one brother told
me. A natural death, are you?
Yes, they all survived the war. Mm-hmm. They died natural deaths. Mm-hmm. I mean, sadly, one sister had an accident and mm-hmm. died.
Yeah.
But one brother who is alive today, he never knows if when he calls me it will be the last time that we talk, because he's well in his 80s, and they're all considerably older, of course.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So he has become a little sentimental, and he said when he was young, he remembers an elegant lady coming to their house, and it was probably 1942. Well, it must have been. And he didn't know who this lady was, but she didn't look like anybody they would normally have encountered. And she was very well dressed, and he found out later that that was my mother. So she actually came to look at where I would be placed.
Oh, okay.
Which was
before
rather,
you were placed.
Before
yeah.
I went mm-hmm. there. So I think that was somewhat unusual mm-hmm. because in many cases, Jewish parents just left their children or threw them out of trains into the hands of strangers mm. or just threw them.
Right.
And mm-hmm. one of my friends who was a hidden child, his nickname when he was two was Cole Flippia. Well, Flippia was an affectionate name. His name is Phil. His parents left him in a coal bin, not even knowing if he would be found.
Mm-hmm.
But he was found.
But they knew it would be worse if they kept
yes.
him.
Yes. They had to take that chance.
Mm-hmm.
So some people just left their children on the street. Some Jewish parents just begged someone to take that child and find a place for a child. So I think this was unusual.
Now, these were folks who knew they were about to be arrested or placed in a concentration camp
yes.
or whatever.
Yes.
They knew that they were.
They were on their way to a train
on their way.
To a
yeah.
camp named Westerbork, mm-hmm. which is where every Dutch Jew mm-hmm. who was caught by the Germans went.
Mm-hmm.
After a certain date. Before that, first they rounded them up. They made it illegal for Jews to live on the shore, on the coast.
Mm-hmm.
I was born in Scheveningen, which was a town on the coast by The Hague.
Mm-hmm.
It was on the coast, and it was very... It was a tourist destination, mm-hmm. I think, and a very nice place. And so we were forced to move inland. And I think eventually, really, the Germans tried to round all the Jews into an area of Amsterdam so that they could round them up. And then
put them in some kind of a ghetto or whatever, just a
yeah, I can't say ghetto because it wasn't like Poland or the East.
Mm-hmm.
But instead of being scattered
yeah.
from the coast to Amsterdam and all around,
I
think they wanted them
in
exactly in a
yeah.
more centralized mm-hmm. setting so they could control mm-hmm. rounding them up. And they sent them all to what was called the Joodse Schouwburg, which was the Jewish theater in Amsterdam. And you either went to Westerbork from there, or maybe earlier in the war you were released
mm-hmm.
in some way or another, only to be caught again at a later date. So I don't know what your question was.
Well, we'll just continue on. I will maybe
yeah.
it'll come to mind. Do you have any recollection of neighbors or people that you knew all of a sudden disappearing? You know,
no, because in hiding, there were no people who were disappearing because I just lived in this small town.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought I lived on a farm. But we had neighbors. I mean, it was a real town with many houses, but no Jewish people particularly.
I see.
Okay. Except next door, they did take in Jews, and that's where a sister-in-law, another sister-in-law, or would-be sister-in-law, lived, because one of the brothers married the girl next door, mm-hmm. and they also took in Jews and hid them.
Mm-hmm. Did you get to know that those children ever, or did you?
I didn't remember the girl. But she remembered me, and we found each other by pure accident in the 60s in Montclair, New Jersey.
No, that's amazing.
It's amazing. She came. That is such an amazing story. Anyway, she didn't stay there. She was hiding there with her mother, and the mother was ostensibly the maid. And she brought her little girl while she was the maid of this household.
She was hiding, you said?
Yes, but not invisibly. She was hiding as the daughter of the maid.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Of course, the mother wasn't a maid, but mm-hmm. they yeah. didn't stay there. They moved on. Mm-hmm. And then it took another child. His name was Yopi. And I never found Yopi, and I don't remember him.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to talk about meeting this woman in Montclair, or is that something we should say?
Well, my aunt, I told you, my grandmother and my maternal aunt and I were the only survivors, and we ended up in New York. And my aunt had a great many friends. And one of them happened to have been a woman named Trixie Fontaine, and she was married to a Dutch man. She was also a German Jew. And her husband was a Dutch Jew, and his name was Jacques Fontaine. And she was widowed at the time, but she sponsored this Rita from next door, who came to America to be a camp counselor.
Mm-hmm.
But she needed to be sponsored, and she came to sightsee and practice her English. And she was in her early 20s, or late 20s, I don't know. And my aunt and Trixie, who were friends, were just visiting one day, and Trixie spoke about the girl who was whom she sponsored that summer. And my aunt said, and not liking to be a name dropper, they nevertheless started dropping names, and where was the girl, and where was she? And it turned out that we had been next door to each other in hiding in Laon. So I found the girl. She didn't have a telephone in Montclair, where she was temporary. She was just there for a very short time. And I don't know why she was in Montclair, but all of that doesn't matter. I must have written a letter to this address, and then we got together. And she started shrieking, "I remember your rooster, and I remember you, and I remember the dreams. You had bad dreams, and you told me your nightmares, I don't know, but she remembered things, which is a little bizarre,
yeah.
because she was a good year younger than I.
Yeah.
So I think maybe her mother refreshed her memory.
Uh-huh.
I don't know how much was true memory.
But she knew enough that you could make the connection,
yes,
for sure.
Yes, and we are still in touch.
Isn't that great?
She lives in Holland.
Okay, well, let's go back then a little bit more, I guess, into the years of 42, 43, things got worse, I would assume, for
things
all families.
Things got much worse.
How did they get worse?
Well, you have to understand that I'm speaking as a five-year-old. So I could tell you the winter of 44 was the hunger winter
mm-hmm.
in Holland. I can only speak about Holland. I can give you a broad overview and compare Holland maybe to some other countries. And then if you want to talk about that later, but in Holland, the winter of 44 was known as the hunger winter, and the food supplies ran out. And we also did eat ground up tulip bulbs because there was no food, and scrounging for dandelion greens, anything that could be eaten. And it was a very, very cold winter. Now, Holland is a very damp, cold, windy climate, so you kind of feel the chill. But that winter was exceptionally cold, and I think we were all feeling, I know I went to bed hungry every night.
Oh, no doubt.
But as one of my sisters said, we never starved. And I think she meant that if you starved, you died of starvation. So of course we never starved. And I can tell you that there were many starving people roaming the streets, knocking on doors, begging for food. And that in the beginning of the war, whatever meager supplies of food we had to share among the 11 of us, there were knocks, constant knocking on the kitchen door in the back of the house. And the two sisters of the three girls who were really in charge of the meals always answered the door and shared. They would give food. Mm. Now, the two sisters were running the cooking and trying to get food, but the boys also helped gathering food because the mother was sick and she died in the war of a brain cancer, the mother of the family.
Oh, Vandenbrink?
Yes.
Ms. Vandenbrink died.
The mother of the, mm-hmm. the Vandenbrinks.
Vandenbrinks, yeah.
She died, it was a very, very traumatic day, but she was always in bed watching everything, mm-hmm. but she was terminally ill. And that's why the sisters were cooking and doing mm-hmm. all that. And the worst day for Zeus, the oldest sister, was when there was no more food and she had to turn somebody away. And at that point, it really, really got difficult. And I know the boy somehow went to a northern province, far, far. You know, Holland is a small country, mm-hmm. but if there's no fuel and there's no food and it's freezing cold, to go to Groningen, which is the furthest province in the north on the east, Friesland would be just to the west of that. So those are the two northern provinces. It was a huge undertaking, also not mm-hmm. to be caught by the Germans.
Oh, yeah, right.
But to try and get some food. So,
and if you were caught, it would be taken away from you, I would assume, anyway.
Yeah, somehow they managed.
Yeah.
I don't really know any of these details. But of course, nothing lasted forever, so. But you lived a little bit from day to day and hoped that there would be some food.
Did you have water?
Yeah, even if it meant melting snow.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember not being without water. Mm-hmm. Right now, here in North Carolina, we're in a beyond severe drought. It's being called exceptional. So I think we're all worried about water, but that never, Holland is full of water. It rains, and I had to walk in snow on wooden shoes, and the snow would clump and you would teeter and totter. But I think there was plenty of water.
So I forgot about the wooden shoes.
Well, I didn't, but, you know, that was not, I wasn't in a Dutch costume always wearing wooden shoes, but I had sneakers. Mm-hmm. We didn't have shoes. We didn't have clothing or shoes. So when my feet grew, they cut the toes out of my sneakers, and my feet just stretched
Over the
way beyond. They were maybe half in and half out. But in the winter, you couldn't go barefoot like that, so somehow I had wooden shoes then.
I guess they carve those. I don't know how they do that, but anyway. So things got worse, and it was primarily lack of food. Do you recollect any more abusive handling on the way, by the way, of the Germans against
the Germans were bombing, and they were making regular house counts, and we would run into, we called it a bomb shelter, but it was really a potato cellar. So we would run in there, and we spent a great amount of time there. You never knew when it would be safe. But during one of the worst bombings, we ran out of the house into this cellar, and the mother was so terminal that we had to leave her behind. That was a terrible trauma. And later that day she died. So, but you have to imagine running out of a house and leaving your mother behind in the face of all this danger.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So they were bad times.
Mr.
Von den Brink,
did he work during this time frame, or what was he doing?
I don't know.
Okay.
I know that he wasn't just a farmer. Mm-hmm. We had fruit trees.
Mm-hmm.
So we could pick fruit, and we would we had apples, and we would peel them and dry them and string them up to dry them. There would be apples across the rooms. And to this day, I love dried apples.
Right.
But I don't know what he did. He was very strict. His children were really afraid of him. He was stern. And this was not a touchy-feely family. And one of my brothers, when he visited right here in Farington, told me that the only time his father ever touched any of us was one time when we were all sitting at the dinner table, and he walked around the table and patted each of us on our heads once. That's the only time his father ever touched
him. That was the expression of love to the family.
But the father, as stern as he was with his children, was very soft with me in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
He was also strict, and I was punished.
End of tape A, side one. The interview continues on tape A, side two.
Okay, well, the tape just ended, but we're going to start up again.
Okay.
Okay, you're talking about Mr. Von Brink and
not knowing what he actually did during the war. I found out as an adult that he did own one or several brick factories in Belgium, so that...
must have been a wealthy man, I guess, in his day.
I don't know. He was... Modesty and humility were all important. There was no way I would have known there was any wealth. Well, there wasn't in the war.
Yeah,
but
right.
I think when he died... By the way, I went to his funeral, and it was the week that my son was being bar mitzvahed. I flew to Holland, and they said I was to walk in the procession after the hearse and with my siblings, my Catholic siblings, and be one of them, and then stand on the line to a receiving line to accept condolences. And it was all very moving. And I only came back to the States on Wednesday, and the bar mitzvah was on Saturday. And that, as you may be aware of, is a very big day in the life of a Jewish
right.
child. Bar mitzvah for a boy, bat mitzvah for a girl.
Mm-hmm.
The age of being recognized as an adult in the Jewish faith. So,
did you consider Mr. Von den Brink basically your father? I mean, this is the only man you ever knew was a father figure.
Yes,
I
called them Papa and Mama while I lived there, and always referred to him as Papa. And he made a more lasting impression because he survived the war, and the mother died of brain cancer. But anyway, you wanted to know about just, a more historical overview.
Yeah, yeah, huh? Anything that you can think of that would be of interest to
people?
Well,
I would say that the war was more difficult in some countries than other countries. And that the war was a two-pronged war. It was so unusual in terms of being World War II on the one hand, but for me the defining point was the fact that it was the Holocaust. And from the viewpoint of the Holocaust and having to survive that, Holland was one of the worst countries to be living in. People think that Poland was the worst, and perhaps more of the Polish people were anti-Semites. They were virulently anti-Semitic as a people. And I don't like to generalize. Of course, there were many righteous Poles too, and righteous Christians among the Poles. And the righteous Christians are referred to as the righteous among the nations in Yad Vashem, which is something I didn't mention beforehand, but that's the official terminology. Mm-hmm. So there were a great many fine Polish people and some true well-known heroes who saved thousands of Jews.
Oh, yes.
But when all is said and done, the majority of the Poles were really anti-Semitic. Holland statistically had the same number of Jews murdered as Poland. 80% or more of the Jews did not survive the Holocaust in Poland and in Holland. And that's something that is not very well known. Also, in Poland, there were more forests and more places to hide. I'm not saying I would rather have been in Poland, because I wouldn't. But Holland is a small country. It doesn't have caves. It doesn't have endless forests. There really are no hiding places. And I think that played a part in very few Dutch Jews actually surviving the war. Also, 1.5 million children were murdered in the Holocaust. So the fact that I survived as a child in Holland is a miracle.
Really remarkable.
Yes, it's remarkable. I don't have the figures of how many children survived, but there were any number of ways that Jews survived. They were either on the run, running in the forests. They might have hidden in haystacks, in barns, but not with permission or sanction of the owner of the
right.
barn necessarily. They hid shockingly in what's it called? I'm just blanking out. Sewers.
Mm-hmm.
A shocking number, and I don't have numbers, of Jews lived in the sewer systems of cities like Warsaw and Krakow. And I don't know if anybody lived in sewers in Holland. Others hid in tiny spaces. The father of a friend of mine hid in a 6x6 space for all those years, and lost his legs after the war.
This was in Holland?
In Holland.
No kidding.
This particular man was in Holland. Hmm. He survived the war, but then he had serious circulatory problems. Mm-hmm. So many people never saw the light of day. Many of the hidden children, and we didn't know there were other hidden children. I never knew there was anybody like me. And I felt very much an outsider. I never spoke about the war or anything. No one knew that I was a survivor. And if anybody did ask, I said I was very little, I don't remember anything, and I was among the lucky ones. And when I came together with other child survivors, hidden children, in a conference, the first International Hidden Child Conference in 1991 in the Marriott Marquis Hotel in Manhattan, I found myself among 1,600 other hidden children. And we found that we had all...
Were they primarily from Holland or other areas too?
They were from around the world, but a lot from Holland. Mm-hmm. A lot living in America, mostly. And a lot of hidden children from from Belgian orphanages run by nuns, run by the Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. But the Catholics weren't the only one who were rescuing Jewish children. So I found that there was this commonality among all of us that we had all been telling people that we were very lucky and that we didn't remember anything and we were the lucky ones. And we considered ourselves lucky because we didn't know that we were Holocaust survivors because we had never been in concentration camps. So we learned that we weren't lucky and that we did suffer and that we were Holocaust survivors. Right. But all this is relatively new, so.
Right. Let's carry back a second back into the World War II years. And do you have any other incidents where maybe did you have any close calls where you felt like you might have been vulnerable to being picked up by the Germans?
I could have been picked up at any point.
Anytime you had the dunce cap on or...
Anytime inside the house, outside the house. But more important is not my one life, but 10 Funderbrinks who risked 10 lives for all those years to hide me, because the punishment was death.
Right.
And you have to understand also that there was a bounty on the heads of Jews in Holland, and I can only speak for Holland. Could have been in other countries, but I just don't know. What would be the equivalent of $2 per person? That is what people got to betray the Anne Frank family. My parents were betrayed. My father's family was betrayed. And probably they got 2 guilders, which wouldn't even, but today the equivalent of $2. Mm-hmm. And I just phoned the Anne Frank Society and because I wanted to know what the actual amount would be. And as of a year ago, in 2006, they advised me that in today's value, it would be the equivalent of $2 per head. So people had some warped motivation for turning Jews in Holland.
I would say. It certainly wasn't any big financial reward.
There were also a lot of willing collaborators. Mm-hmm. And that's what I wanted to say, hand in hand with places like Poland. You had a lot of righteous among the nations in Holland, and you had tremendous number of collaborators who were known as NSBers, very willing. And if you study history, and I am not a student of history, you can find out the names of these people because some were rather well known. And Holland was a very difficult country to survive in.
Do you recall, as you got a little older then, when you were closer to maybe 7 or 8 years old, did you have any, when the German soldiers came to your house, you had some warning, you say, through the underground?
Sometimes not.
Sometimes not. Do you recall what the event was like? Did you pounding on the door and let us in and this kind of thing?
Well,
how did they get in to
check out? No, I don't remember pounding on the door, but they would have done that if they had been on a Russia to take Jews, mm-hmm. but this was a Catholic, this was a Christian house. Mm-hmm. So they may have been at the door, but they would have been let in because you didn't say no. Mm-hmm. And there was palpable fear. We were kind of quaking in our shoes.
Yeah, no doubt. Yeah.
And the sounds of their German and their orders and their shouting. To this day, if German is spoken, I cannot hear it.
Mm-hmm. Just.
I will speak German in Italy because I have a feeling of some kind of safety. I like to be in
right.
Italy.
So even today, when you hear, say, loud German voices, this
bothers recoil.
You?
It more than bothers me. It's very, very distressing for
mm-hmm.
me.
That's interesting. Yeah. Stress disorder, I guess you could say, from those
of course,
early days.
It is. Yeah. It is. Yeah. And it will never go away.
Mm-hmm.
And I will not go to Germany or not buy German products
mm-hmm.
if I can help it.
Right.
I have unknowingly bought German things, mm-hmm. but I would not buy a German car. I make it very clear that that's my problem.
Mm-hmm.
For my generation, and my children are free to do as they please, mm-hmm. and that should not be a burden for them.
Mm-hmm.
So what they do is their affair, but they would not buy a German car either.
They wouldn't pull it up in your driveway anyway.
Well, right? they have their own feelings, but
right.
I can be friends with Germans, but yeah. It will take me a while before I trust someone. On a one-on-one, people work out very well together. Jews and Arabs can work very well, Germans and Jews, but on a one-on-one, and we should just leave the governments out of it.
Let's talk a little bit about, unless you want to bring something specific else out, let's talk a little bit about as the war is winding down, do you have any recollection of any changes or maybe conditions changed for you? Before the end of the war, or was it
just
more
that
of the same?
As the war, as we got deeper and deeper into the war, became more difficult to get food and to stay warm, mm-hmm. and our clothing supplies and our shoes had long since run out. Now there's talk about our lost childhood, but I didn't know at the time that I had mm-hmm. lost a childhood. I mean, these are only adult.
Right.
Recognitions.
So getting close to when the war was actually over.
This is another point I would like to
yeah,
make.
let's talk about
people
that.
Dance in the street.
Mm-hmm.
And it was tremendously exciting. And they were shouting and dancing. And I was the privileged child in the Van der Brink family who went to get the first loaf of, I think it was Norwegian bread, and it looked like snow white bread. Mm-hmm. And I had never seen or tasted anything like that. And now, of course, we don't favor snow white bread, but what a luxury. It was the most beautiful thing. And the privilege of being the one to bring this into the household, to have been the one sent out to mm-hmm. get this, was very great, but all of this faded very quickly in my life, and that child survivors, I have to say, the war years were my best years until I married a really wonderful man, and that my life went absolutely sour when the war was over. And I was
you're only 8 years older.
Right. And I was uprooted on a continuing basis
mm-hmm.
and ended up in a very psychologically abusive family.
Where?
In the Adirondack Mountains
okay.
in New York.
How did you get to the
I have never been physically abused, but they were
How did you get there?
Well,
from Holland to
those people, my grandmother and my aunt and I, who survived the war, briefly lived together in a very damp, cold house in another town called Bilthoven in Holland. And I know there were, what, I don't know what you call it in English. It's fungi in Italian. It's, well, they're toadstools or fungi. Mm-hmm.
Mushrooms?
Yes. Mushrooms, but not the edible kind, growing on the walls of my bedroom because it was very damp.
Yeah.
So, anyway, but it was nice living with my grandmother. I worshipped, I adored my grandmother.
Was this a loving environment, I take?
Oh, yes, with my grandmother. Mm-hmm. It was wonderful. And she was...
Was this your mother's mother?
My mother's mother. Mm-hmm. Everybody worshipped her. She was one of the strongest, most admirable people you could ever encounter. And besides that, she was beautiful.
How did she survive, by the way? Was she in Holland also?
She was in Holland. My entire family is German. They were all from a city named Breslau in Germany. Mm-hmm. Now Breslau is Wrocław or something in Poland. Borders change. Mm-hmm. But my grandmother was a woman who was so ahead of her time. She was born in 1884. She went to work. She was involved in the business, in the family business, and had a maid and a cook and sometimes I think a chauffeur, people to run the household. She was very modern. She smoked when she was 16, and she married. She had a love marriage, not an arranged marriage, and all this was very avant-garde. So she was very liberated, very modern, and always learned the new language. She learned Dutch when she fled to Holland, learned English when we came to America, and was very dignified. Had no money after the war, the Second World War. She also survived the First World War. Mm-hmm. And my father and my grandfather were soldiers, German soldiers in the First World War. The irony of all this is an outrage. Mm-hmm. She survived this mega inflation where money was worthless in Germany by her wits, her intelligence, and that's how she survived the Holocaust. By, she was hiding on the run. She was in many places.
She outwitted.
She was moving. Much of it was wits, and much of it was a sixth sense. Mm-hmm. My aunt and my grandmother sometimes were on the run together, and sometimes they were hiding separately. And once, when the Jews were already limited to Amsterdam and were not allowed to cook, it was illegal for Jews to have food or cook for themselves or to buy eggs. You could not have an egg. And there were crazy rules. You couldn't shop in the best times of the day. You couldn't be out on the streets. There were horrible, horrible rules. You couldn't go to school, you couldn't practice law or medicine or anything. So they had to go to places where they had to eat dinner or, you know, get a meal. They weren't restaurants, but that's where they went to eat. And once my aunt and my grandmother were together in Amsterdam, and my aunt said, "Something feels wrong about it. We're not going in." And that place was raided while they were still within seeing distance of it. So they just missed getting caught. And then they went to a safe house at another time, altogether different time, in the country, because they were always on the run. And they were together again at that time. And then my grandmother, my aunt sensed something off about dinner in that place. But my grandmother sensed something was off at the safe house in the country. And again, they just missed being raided.
Mm.
But at another time, my aunt was in a house in Amsterdam visiting a friend. And the Germans came unannounced on a house search, and my aunt ran into a closet. But you didn't have walk-in closets. You had pieces of furniture that were closets. So mm-hmm. she ran yeah. into this piece of furniture and crouched behind clothing, scared out of her wits, but she didn't get caught. And the friend must have been Christian. And the Germans were out of the house. My aunt came out of the closet, but she had to desperately go to the toilet. So there was no toilet in the house. It was on one of the canals, one of those very ancient houses in Amsterdam. So she ran into the outhouse in the back, and there was a German soldier who had also gone to the outhouse. But she wasn't caught. She just,
amazing,
nothing
yeah.
happened that time. Yeah. So sometimes it was luck. Mostly it was wits. It was a combination of factors.
So how were you reunited with your grandparents? How did they find you, or you find them?
My grandmother knew where I was.
Oh, she did.
Once, for my birthday in the war, I know that she knew where I was, because wherever she was hiding, she walked for 2 nights and hid in the whatever forest she could find in the day, so that she would appear briefly on my birthday, this 1 year. Maybe it was when I was for my 5th birthday. But she couldn't stay, and she couldn't be seen in daylight. And that's why she walked for 2 nights. And my birthday's in December.
Were you the only grandchild too, by the way?
Yes, I was an only child.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, my family did not have, I was the only child in many, many years.
Mm-hmm.
So I was very doted upon child. And you can imagine walking in December to appear for my birthday.
Mm.
So
that's so why she knew where you were then.
I know she okay. knew where I was. And so we were reunited. But my grandmother was without funds. I mean, at that point, she had nothing left. So a cousin of my mother's, who came with her husband in the 30s for their medical residencies. They graduated, both of them, medical school in Germany. There were many, many women who went to medical school and became doctors in Germany. Many Jewish women of my mother's generation. And so this was a cousin, and I knew 7 other Jewish women who were doctors of that age, who, you know, ended up in America and practiced medicine. So they came, did their residency, and established a medical practice in the Adirondacks. So they had the space, and they had funds, and they had an only child. And they thought that would be very nice for her to have a sister.
Mm-hmm.
And so they took me, because my aunt and my grandmother were without funds and didn't have physical space.
Right.
So we couldn't live together, which is really a shame, because that child in the house had always been an only child, and their little fantasy idea backfired.
Yeah.
From the first night I was there, it completely backfired, and they couldn't send me back to the store. They were stuck with me, and I was stuck with them.
Mm. So it was an unhappy experience.
From the first night on, it was horrendous.
And you were only, what, 8 or 9 at this time?
I was 10 and a half.
10 and a half, okay.
So from the age of 10 until I married, but I married as a young woman, My life was a living hell, and surviving survival is what became the most difficult thing of my life. Mm.
So you had a very, very bad experience, and that lasted for
10 years.
10 years.
But it lasted beyond that because they damaged me seriously, emotionally. I will say I was not alone, and that it was fairly typical for child survivors to have their lives fall apart after the war. Mm-hmm. And that is what I would like people to be aware of. This is a greater message about war.
Because you were an orphan, basically.
But there were children whose parents, either both parents survived or one parent survived. And their lives were a living hell too, because their parents were seriously damaged and their family dynamics didn't work in the same way as before the war. Mm-hmm. Nothing was the same. And so whether you're a child in Darfur or Vietnam or anywhere in Asia or Africa or in Europe where there was war, you're not healed when the war is over. And nothing is right after the war is finished. Mm-hmm. And the war never ends. And some people say their lives ended with the war, which is a rather dramatic statement. And I think people have to understand what war really is.
Even as a child.
Well, as a child who is going to never have a normal life after the war. Any war.
Yeah, well, like I said, you're an orphan.
So for the victim of a Shoah, it's rather unique because you cannot explain why just because you were born with the title of Jew, you were hunted down to be erased from the face of the earth. What you ever did to make that happen is a little different from tribal wars or where two countries are warring when it's not tribal. This was unique.
True.
But I'm just saying
very
that
profound.
No matter whether you're a child of a war in Vietnam or Korea or Uganda or Darfur or Ethiopia or wherever you were, you will be scarred. Those children are never the same.
The family that you lived with in the Adirondacks, were they Christian or Jewish?
Oh, no, they were Jewish.
They were Jewish.
My mother's cousin and the man she married.
Okay. So did you continue with your education in the Adirondacks? I guess you went to school then?
Well, they told me every day that I was stupid.
Oh, so.
And that, for instance, bridge was a game for intelligent people, and I was not intelligent. Therefore, I could not learn bridge. I once played tennis, and my husband came back in the house with me. We were visiting them. And he said, oh, he was worn out. And that was a great game of tennis. And she said, well, surely not with Renee. She couldn't play. I couldn't do anything from the time I was 10. And their idea of play was their daughter had a bike and she'd say, let's go play bicycles. I ride my bike and you run after it. And I was like Cinderella.
Yeah.
And they, it was a very emotionally abusive. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yes.
To be told every day that you're nothing and that you're so dumb. Mm-hmm. And especially because they were doctors, I found, you know, they were the authorities. And our generation didn't question authority.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Now.
So you were a very confused child, too, I'm sure. By what was.
Well, I didn't have very much self-worth.
Yeah.
So my husband worked very hard at it. And he adored me, and I had this wonderful marriage.
So how did you meet your husband? And well, first
just
of all,
at the University of Vermont.
Okay, you went to your
so nobody was exactly screaming to pay tuition. I mean, the family where I was generous. They fed me very well. They clothed me very well. I mean, I couldn't choose my clothing. I was outfitted. Mm-hmm. I had no say. But they were extremely generous to house me, to bring me up. And I can only thank them for that. Mm-hmm. But the damage they did.
Yeah.
He was a nice man, but he didn't stand up to his wife. And she was very, very cruel.
Mm-hmm. Sounds that way.
And he was, I would say, a very gentle shell of a man, but according to him, I could do no right either. Mm-hmm. I never did anything right. And the rules kept changing. So if I did what I thought was right, the next day that was wrong. So I never knew what the rules were. Mm-hmm. And I tried very hard. And another thing about the child survivors is that wherever we were extremely well behaved, which is difficult because, you know, I was a guest in everybody else's house. So I couldn't act out, and I was always a very good little girl. And that was the universal thing. We were all very good little children.
Mm-hmm.
So
repressed, I guess, in many respects.
Well,
you couldn't be yourself.
If we misbehaved, we could be thrown out.
Mm-hmm.
So. Yeah.
So you went to the University of Vermont, take it?
Yes.
Did you get a scholarship there? Or did they?
No. It was 1956. It was dirt cheap. Even as an out-of-stater, it was dirt cheap. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe $300 or something. I don't know. For them, it was not a hardship, and they were generous, as I said. They did not encourage me, because not all of us were college material, and I was among the stupid. So I made Dean's List, and I said, that's it. And I dropped
out. What did you
major
in, Renee?
Well, I had absolutely no sense of self-worth. I didn't know what I wanted to be when I grew up, and I was scared stiff that they would throw me out of college, and that they accepted me. And then I had this imposter feeling that they would find out very quickly that I was not college material, mm-hmm. and that I would make it on the popularity level. I would make friends, but they would toss me out of school because they would find out their huge mistake in accepting me. So I didn't know what I wanted to major in, and I was really, really frightened. So I did the Dean's List thing, and I dropped out.
Oh, you dropped out.
Yeah. I have no credentials. And I've tried to reconcile this all my life because it didn't help my feeling of any kind of validity.
Mm-hmm.
And my friends have so many credentials, and here I am, nothing. So
I didn't say that.
It's a lot to reconcile in my life.
So where did you meet your husband? To be.
I met him at the University of Vermont.
Mm-hmm. And you married?
He proposed to me in less than 24 hours.
So and you got married in...
No, I didn't accept. He finally gave me an ultimatum after many months. Not many months, because we married almost a year later, but from March to November, he gave me an ultimatum. It was the best thing that ever happened to me. So I was a very fortunate person.
Mm-hmm. Good. Okay, so then just briefly carry on where you live, and also I want to hear about what you're doing back over in Israel. I know you went to a conference not too long ago.
I just came back from Israel.
So why don't we just carry on through the rest of your life,
right,
and then talk about the... what you're doing today.
Well, I married in 1958, and We had two children. I spent 45 years learning how to say we, and now I'm working very hard at saying I since my husband died.
Sure.
I would have been married 50 years next March. Mm-hmm. The children are grown and lead very productive lives and are wonderful people. I, as I mentioned earlier, went to this Hidden Child conference in Manhattan in 1991. And that was a turning point in my life. And as it was for so many of us who had never come face to face with our past until that year.
Now, you never really talked about it either?
Never, never. People knew me, never knew. I always felt different. I felt alienated from the white picket fence. Could not relate to people because I just didn't have their experience. Mm-hmm. People talked about things that I couldn't relate to. And so instead of being sad, I somehow would act a little angry because I could camouflage my feelings. But I never belonged. After 1991, we began to understand ourselves on a whole
new... And the psychological impact that you probably never really
really
dealt with.
What I was, that I was different and that terrible things had happened. And that not only was I different, there were other people like me. Mm-hmm. I never knew that what I was had a name, the name being Hidden Child. And now it is a whole designation for people like me. So this was brand new, and it really was revolutionary. And I have evolved, and I have grown since that year. So at first it was financially difficult for me to go and to each and every year, if it was held abroad. We were frantically scrambling to put some money aside for retirement because my husband started his own business, and it wasn't easy. Now I'm all alone, and...
Where were you living then, by the way, when you...
Oh, the first conference, I was already living in Farington.
Uh-huh.
Because I moved to Farington in 1989, and this was the 1991 conference.
So your husband was in business here then?
Yes, yes. Yeah. But he was still really trying to get this off the ground. So he would, at some later point, he would come with me. And that was wonderful. But he came in the early days before they had any programs for spouses. My son has come to conferences with me, but he's now so busy.
Where does he live?
He lives very nearby in Chapel Hill.
Oh, in Southern Village.
And he runs our business, which is really going to be, it's fully his business. He's given his life over to it. He works 7 days a week. Mm. He goes to, you know, he travels a great deal on business. So he hasn't been able to come with me, and I really hope he can come next year again, because there are a lot of second generation. My children are called by this child survivor group, they are called second generation, and my grandchildren are called third generation, and they are becoming active in the annual conferences. So this past year was in Jerusalem, a very fitting place, mm-hmm. and I have just returned from Israel attending that.
Now, what goes on there?
We have
these conferences.
We gather, and now instead of just being a Hidden Child conference, it has grown to encompass all child survivors, which means child survivors of the Holocaust. They could have been camp survivors, they could have been in the Kinder Transport, which is children who were sent to England, mm-hmm. Which was not occupied. To safety. Some families went to Shanghai. A handful of families may have gone as far as Japan, but there were a number of Jewish families in Shanghai. It's all level of children who survived the Holocaust at some point, even if they fled Europe in the 30s. And we come together every year, and normally 300-400 people gather. And in Israel, there were over 800 people because a lot of Israelis were able to come who normally might not be able to come, you know, if it's in America.
And what does the organization do for folks
when,
like
when
you?
When we gather, we begin normally at Shabbat, which is the sundown on Friday. Jewish holidays and holy days always begin at sundown the evening before. So that is the Sabbath meal, and that's when we begin. We register, by then we're registered, and there's a big sit-down dinner. Those who want to attend a little service before dinner go to the service to begin Shabbat. Then we have plenary sessions with major speakers. Often it'll be an ambassador or a governor or a minister of justice or any number of them at any one conference, people with recognizable names. We break into workshops with various titles addressing some aspect that's relevant to our experience. And usually at the conferences, we've been starting out with age-related workshops because of our impaired memories, so that people who were born before 1935 might go to one workshop because they have better memory, or maybe say prior to 1933, and then maybe from 1930-something to 1938, another group with smaller memories. And then there are a lot of child survivors who were born during the war itself, you know, after the war started at different times in different countries.
Right. 39 in Poland, September 1st.
And 1940, May, in Holland, the Germans invaded Holland on May 10th in 1940. And on May 14th, Holland surrendered and we were an occupied country.
Right.
In Hungary, times were bad, but the war really only started there in 1944. In the south of Holland, the war was over in the fall of 1944. One of my friends was free when our war was going on in northern Holland until May of 1945. Mm-hmm. So the dates are so different for beginning and ending. Mm-hmm. So the age-related workshops are relevant for our memories because so many children were born in 1942, 1943, even 44. Well, not many, for obvious reasons, but any number of child survivors were born during those years, and some of them were hidden in bureau drawers or just little tiny places.
So this is a history gathering organization too. You're developing history every year when people come back.
Well, there are history gatherers at our organizations. Mm-hmm. There are always people from Yad Vashem, from the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. Mm-hmm. There are people from the Red Cross. There are all sorts of people, also depending on which country we're meeting in. So, yes. And then there are booksellers, because many of my, I can't say colleagues, because it's not a professional organization, but other hidden children have written autobiographies. Mm-hmm. And so they're all available there. And each year I try to buy at least one book so that people can come to my house and borrow books. So between plenary sessions, workshops, We have now also come to mean that we meet the friends we've made over the years.
Sure.
And then at night we sometimes gather by country.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a Dutch room, a Belgian room, a Hungarian room, a French room. And
so you would perhaps meet people who were in the same city that you had no idea they were there in this kind of thing?
Yes, that can happen.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes within a workshop, when people talk about their experience, and they may mention somebody else. I was in a workshop once where Dorit was talking about someone who died in an air raid, and
end of tape A, side two. The interview continues on tape B, side one.
Okay, so
so there are these absolutely extraordinary
moments.
Moments.
Mm-hmm.
And I know of a woman, a Polish woman, Ida, who has found her twin brother.
Oh no! Through the conference.
No, not
through,
the conference.
People that they.
But somehow there are always.
Mm-hmm.
At the conferences, there are search boards, great big easels with huge pads of blank paper. And at every conference, it would be heartbreaking if you had never been at a conference before, because it's
people searching.
It's shocking. It's it's really shocking. So many people still searching for loved ones.
Uh-huh.
Or
even today.
Searching, oh, very much today. It's like, this is not diminishing. Searching for even a clue as to someone who might have been in the same place where they were, such as an orphanage in Belgium, who might shed a little light on their past. There are child survivors who don't have a single photograph, who don't have a birth certificate, who don't know even who they are.
Mm.
There are the unknown children. I mean, there are so many categories.
Mm-hmm.
And they're searching for anything that will shed light on where they came from, who they are, and what they came from.
Mm.
And there are two sisters who found each other just a handful of years ago, and then the Polish twins. Ida, who's been living in America, and her twin brother, who's been living in Poland, didn't even know he was Jewish and married a non-Jewish woman who's an anti-Semite. But really a nasty anti-Semite.
Mm.
And has suffered, this Polish man has suffered horribly. He's now in the process of getting his green card and living with his sister.
Mm.
In the Midwest. There are
amazing
so
stories.
Many shocking and extraordinary stories.
Mm-hmm.
So that's about it.
Yeah. Well, and life goes on, but it'll never be quite right based on your background. There are always going to be some big question marks and confusion.
Yes, and trauma.
Mm-hmm.
And it isn't just, I'm not talking about myself.
Mm-hmm.
Talking about the larger picture of child survivors of any and all wars who don't have adult tools to deal with what has happened to them.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that I would, that my life would be ended when my husband died, because we were such best friends and we were in such a very lucky marriage, and that I would have no life without him. But I found that I have adult tools to deal with his death, and that I have been able to handle that, and that there is a huge difference for children who don't have those tools, who don't have the understanding.
Mm-hmm.
And I think before nations go to war, they ought to think that war does not end when it's over.
Mm. Oh, very profound. It doesn't. Well, you're living history of that. Anything else you'd like to say, Renee, before we conclude this?
I found out something.
For your kids or grandkids or
Oh, well, I wish I had brought this. It's not an aphorism. I don't know what it's called. It's by a famous minister. You may want to erase this from the tape since his name, I know his name very well because he's one of the most respected.
Not Billy Graham, for example.
No. Before that, no, not an evangelist at all, but a Protestant minister who said, first, they came for the communists, but I wasn't a communist, so I didn't stand up.
Yeah, I've heard.
Then they came for the Catholics, but I wasn't a Catholic, so I didn't stand up for them.
Yeah.
It goes to this effect. I cannot quote it verbatim. Then they came, oh no, they came for the Jews, obviously, before the Catholics. I wasn't a Jew, so I didn't say anything. And then they came for the Protestants. And then they came for me, but there was nobody left to speak up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But you better erase this because I misquoted and I don't have the name at the tip of my tongue at this very second.
Well, we'll look it up and check it out.
I can go home because it's in my notes, but that's how I end my talks because it leaves a larger message.
Yeah, right.
I am just one Shoah survivor, but there is a larger message.
Define Shoah for me in the
Shoah
Hebrew.
Is the Hebrew word for Holocaust.
Okay. Okay. Anything else you'd like to say, Renee?
No,
well, looks like we finished it up, and I appreciate your being here very, very much. And
well, I hope I've added something
I know that people will be very interested in hearing what you have to say. Thank you very much. Bye. As a postscript to my interview with Ms. Fink, I'd like to quote what Martin Niemöller said, and Renee Fink was alluding to. First, they came for the Jews, but I did not speak out because I was not a Jew. Then they came for the communists, but I did not speak out because I was not a communist. Then they came for the trade unionists, but I did not speak out because I was not a trade unionist. Then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak out for me. And this is a quote from Pastor Martin Niemöller. In addition, a quote from Elie Wiesel, who was a noted author and, of course, a Nobel Prize winner and a noted person in Holocaust matters. And he said, "If we forget, we are guilty. We are accomplices." This recording was made December 7th, 2007. And that concludes my interview with Mrs. Renee Fink.